This is Ridgely Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It's Reporters Roundtable Thursday. It's where we bring in the reporters from local media to talk about the stories that they've posted online as well as in print, in the case of the Times and the Post-Tribune. One fellow who has a lot of material online is Ken Davidson. He's the creator and the publisher of the Northwest Indiana Gazette blog, which is available out there on the internet. And Ken's with us from his office in some undisclosed location, I suppose. Or maybe in your car. I don't know, too. It's hard to say where.
I am in the car. It's a nice, quiet place to take these calls. And thank you for having me.
Oh, you're welcome here. One of the things, the latest thing, actually, that you have posted on your site is some video of part of a meeting that was held at the Art House in Gary yesterday evening, a public forum, and it ended up being a public forum that also ended up being a part of their Facebook Live broadcast, if you want to call it that, that they had on the city of Gary's Facebook page concerning the concerns about how funds for the emergency medical service and public safety accounts had been misappropriated. And there's quite a bit of controversy that has developed around that. A lot of it because more has come to light after a final account analysis was done by an outside accounting firm. We know that that the city has faced a lot of controversy, a lot of criticism over the misappropriation of the funds, which are supposed to be used exclusively for emergency services and for fire safety equipment. And we have a clip here for a couple of minutes of what took place at the public forum last evening, a very small part of the hour and a half long conversation that was actually aired. And we have with Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson, who talks about, I guess, what has basically been done so far in the results after the investigation and the attorney report that is now in the hands of not only the Indiana State Board of Accounts, but I guess now the Gary Common Council. Here's the clip.
This really is designed to be largely about answering questions that you may have as citizens of this community or members of the public. But so that you will know, we have now segregated the 224 funds in a separate account at a different bank from the general fund. So that makes it significantly harder to transfer funds back and forth. In addition to that, the fire chief has the ability to now look at the balance of the 224 account online, because he is the person through whose department those funds and that fund particularly flows. And so he and his staff have access to see that account. Separate and apart from what you've already heard, there's a dashboard that comes to me every month. I am now going to share that with the council president, and on that dashboard would be both the RDS balance in 224 as well as the actual account balance of 224. Now that the report has been completed, we will have to go before the council to make certain requests because that was recommended both by the State Board of Accounts. The final report has already been forwarded. It was forwarded the day after we received it to the State Board of Accounts electronically, and they will now take additional measures to determine what the next steps are relative to the $132,000. If they determine that there is repayment that is appropriate, if they determine that further investigation needs to be done, that would then occur at their direction, and certainly at the direction of the Indiana Attorney General or any other law enforcement authority who would take interest in the case. And so going forward, we know that it has to be conducted differently, and we have already undertaken those measures.
That is one of the couple excerpts we're going to play here from the conversation with the Gary Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson at that meeting last evening, a public forum, and it turned out to also be a broadcast on the Facebook live broadcast on the Team Gary Indiana Facebook page. Let's bring Ken Davidson in from the Northwest Indiana Gazette. Ken, you were there at the meeting. Tell us about atmosphere of the place. A lot of things was discussed, and a lot of very technical material was brought out here. I imagine there were probably a lot of people that were listening intently and trying to figure things out.
Can we back up 1 second just for your listeners to explain what happened here?
Yeah, let's
because you mentioned the RDS system and the bank balance.
Okay, yeah, that's right. Because we've mentioned before, I guess, in some of the news accounts here about the fact that money has been shifted around, and I guess the question is now is how much, if any, of it, we don't know for sure exactly yet, may have been misappropriated. We know for sure that there was some funds that were used for other purposes that probably should not have been.
Right, and those are two separate questions. But first, just to break it down really easily, there's an internal accounting system which would be similar to your check register as an individual. And so, you know, you write down your checks, and at the end of the month, you balance that against what the bank sends you. And what happened was Common Council Member Levita Sparks-Wade discovered in March of this year that there was about a $4 million difference between what was in the bank in the 224 fund and what was posted in the RDS system.
Mm-hmm.
So their basic check register. So when she mentions that RDS system, excuse me, their check register was, I think it was $3.9 million off. It was showing a balance of $4.2 million, and it was actually $330,000 in that account. So that was where the discrepancy first was noticed, that the bank statement didn't match the internal accounting system. And that's what we have here. And so then the question is, where was the money transferred? Now, a lot of it went to cover payroll, and the council members are saying that's entirely appropriate. We certainly would have approved that. If you came to us and said, you need money to cover payroll, of course we want our employees to get paid, we would have just said okay. So the question is, why wasn't that done?
You mentioned too about Councilwoman Sparks-Wade. We have some comments we'll have a little later on for this. She and County Councilman Jamal Washington got together for a Facebook Live rebuttal to what was mentioned by the mayor at the public forum last night. So we'll have that a little bit later here. So it's I imagine probably, like you said, it's a confusing matter anyway, although it shouldn't be. As you've broken it down here, talking about it's very basic accounting that somehow or another something has slipped through the cracks, and I know that's what the concern is. But when you get to the magnitude of what the city of Gary is facing, it becomes a lot bigger problem, I would imagine.
Absolutely. And so, you know, she wants to stress that all is accounted for except $132,000. But it's important to note that there are several transfers that have no notation as to what they're for. They're, you know, $100,000, $50,000 at a time. But one of the transfers is for $500,000, and it says to cover a shortage in the account. So if you're $500,000 overdrawn, putting $500,000 in that account to cover it doesn't explain where the money went, because the money's already been spent. You're just covering it.
Mm-hmm. One of the interesting points I note in taking a listen to what the mayor had to say in her comments last night, and I have a clip of that, and which since you were there, you heard this as well. It was kind of an answer to a question. I think that the question was basically, what would be a response by an individual's response for the money that was missing here, and how the city is going to account for it? Here's what Mayor Freeman Wilson had to say in answering this question.
It is determined that someone has converted any funds to their own personal use, has stolen any money, then they will be prosecuted. That is the reason for referring the report to the State Board of Accounts, to begin to make that additional determination about the $132,000. But that is also the reason that we have asked for the next steps as it relates to the Bank 10 account and the other accounts that make up the Special Revenue Fund or Bank 10 account. As it relates to the who can transfer dollars, it's the controller and the deputy controller. They are the individuals who are generally involved in either directing or completing the transfers. Now, they also have staff members that sign off, but all of those transfers occur in the finance department. None of that occurs in the mayor's office or any other department, because we should be able to depend on a finance department and that is led by a controller who will conduct business in that way. There were internal controls in place. They were not followed. But we certainly are glad, we would be glad to provide those internal controls, because they were actually passed as an ordinance through the Common Council. So they did exist, they do exist.
That's Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson as part of the conversation during the public forum last evening. And I believe that, and Ken, let me know if you think this is different, but I believe that maybe the question came about because we know that the assistant controller for the city of Gary was fired, and the controller who had retired but had a consultancy contract in turn, that got canceled as well, I guess, in light of all of what's had happened here.
That's correct. And the city controller was the longtime city controller. There's also an internal auditor who has not been mentioned in all of this as to what her role in this was. They did mention, sort of throw under the bus, I think, that's my characterization, Sender and Company, who they said was no longer doing any accounting work for the city of Gary. One thing to keep in mind is when we go back in time, it's difficult to put two and two together sometimes, but this from January 1st, 2015, is right at the time that the IT scandal was discovered. So I would anticipate that any responsible controller would tighten things down so tight after $1.5 million in computer equipment apparently walked out the doors through open purchase orders, you would think that, you know, things would be clamped down so tight and the mayor would be on top of it as to what was happening with the transfers of funds. Now, the State Board of Accounts has repeatedly, 11 separate audits, the past 11, actually 12, counting this one, because of this audit, they note that we made this comment in the past 11 audits, repeatedly told them to stop doing these interfund transfers and to repay the money.
Mm-hmm.
The federal court in the Gary Sanitary District consent decree case also has repeatedly chastised them for transferring money from Gary Sanitary District to the city fund. It's a situation where there seems to be a need for an outside accounting entity before it's too late. I let me make this clear. I don't think anybody wrote a check to themselves and anybody stole any money. I really don't believe that at this point. There's no evidence of it. I think it's just really poor practices and really sloppy accounting. I don't think there's any evidence that anybody was stealing money. Even the $132,000, I think they're going to find that. And, you know, it was spent on city stuff. But there are questions regarding priorities and who's supposed to make those decisions, whether it's the council or the mayor alone. These transfers completely usurp the authority of the Gary Common Council.
We're talking with Ken Davidson with the Northwest Indiana Gazette. And now let's take up the questions that were discussed and brought out in a Facebook Live broadcast that City Councilwoman LaVita Sparks-Wade had with Lake County Councilman Jamal Washington on their site in response to the mayor's town forum. Here is their response to the audit by Curtis Whitaker.
Let's get it clear. Disclaimer. I like Curtis Whitaker, so my opinions might be biased, but I have liked Mr. Whitaker for years. I think he's beyond reproach. I think he's an amazing guy, just to be clear. The problem is a lot of people think that it might be tainted for the perception of having someone local that's tied to the city. Mm-hmm. It is my belief. I think he's going to report whatever he got, and that's part of the reason why he probably only did it to 2015. But with that being said, they paid him $50,000 for one fund out of 146 funds. Am I correct?
Right.
So out of 146 funds, we saw a discrepancy of over $8 million. Ladies and gentlemen, what about the other funds? So if we're looking at a trend, that's my first thought process. If we're looking at a trend, there's something that, that could be happening, and other funds that need to be looked at. Now, how do we address that?
Right.
$50,000 for one fund. Can you pay $50,000 for 146 funds?
I don't think so.
So this is when we reach out to State Board of Accounts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let them do that investigative audit. It's not, I'm not saying the mayor did anything wrong. I'm not saying anyone did anything wrong. What I'm saying is just look at it. I remember, and every mayor, not just this mayor, everyone said they're going to do a forensic audit. Was that forensic audit done? If not, let's make, let's start going over there because something is wrong. Now, LaVita, my next point is they said $4.5 million roughly came out for payroll. Okay, now they cannot use that money for payroll. So what money are they going to use for payroll now? Now you have another deficit. So we was talking about long time, a year ago, it was $9 million. Then it jumped to $11 million because it goes up by $3 million per year. Okay? And that's what happens when you don't make enough cuts or if you don't have increased revenue or if your tax collection is going down and you're not making the proper cuts. It just works out that way. Now, you have another deficit that you wasn't aware of. So we was, when you talk about pay Peter, rob Peter to pay Paul, you sit in a car. That's a prime example.
That is Councilwoman LaVita Sparks-Wade and County Councilman Jamal Washington. That is courtesy of their Facebook page, which is entitled The Real Deal and Region. I know you know these people, Ken, and you've heard the comments, what they've had to say. Anything that you'd like to add or chime in on?
Sure. The first thing that I think it's important for people to understand is that, and this is not disparaging Mr. Whitaker, it's a statement with regard to generally accepted accounting principles. This is not an independent analysis of this account. Mr. Whitaker was involved in, if you look at the State Board of Accounts report, he is listed as the financial advisor who was in the meeting for the audit. He was part of Team Gary, the committee to elect Karen Freeman Wilson in 2011, but he currently still works for the City of Gary as an outside accountant. And so if it were an independent audit by an independent firm, I think people would feel a little more comfortable with the results. And again, that is not in any way meant to disparage Mr. Whitaker or the work that he did. And I think he did some good work with what he had to, with the charge he was given. He traced at a certain point, and then I think the funds need to be traced further than that.
We talked here before the break about the concern that I guess, of course, the city has about how the money was spent, that there was probably no personal malfeasance. But I'm sure that there, because of all these questions, is, okay, the money was in the account. It's now missing. Where did the money go? And I guess the question comes down to is what was paid out of that fund? If it all went to salaries, if it did go to equipment like it should have, and anything else that the city may have needed to pay for at the time.
Well, there's an overarching issue here, and part of that issue is, why is there so much money in the fund? Fees are supposed to cover costs, and you know there are court cases and other decisions with relation to this, and this is what the City of Hammond has been going back and forth with on their inspection fee for rental properties, which was in the news a couple of years ago. Fees are supposed to cover costs. They're not supposed to be a windfall to the city. And so what costs are these fees covering? So I think that they pay, you know, certain EMS personnel and things like that. But the council, I don't think, would ever turn down a request. And it could be actually a routine monthly thing if they needed it. Or they could amend the ordinance that firefighter salaries could be paid out of this fund. I don't think anybody would have a problem with that if there's enough money left over for equipment and supplies. The thing that I think many of your listeners may not understand is that there were stories of fire engines that couldn't get oil changes or brakes or just basic routine maintenance, and that equipment was broken down, causing delayed responses because the nearest piece of equipment wasn't available when there was a fire, and some of these fires resulted in death. So this isn't just, you know, we transferred some money. There are serious issues with relation to the status of the fire equipment in the City of Gary. There were times when there was only one or two engines running for the entire 54-square-mile city.
I recall two of the stories that were in the media at the time too. It goes along with that about the fact that the fire department was not only short on equipment, but they were doing what they can to cover the area with the staff they had, because fire stations had to be closed because of expenses.
Right, that's correct, and either they were closed because of the expenses, or they didn't, or they had no equipment to operate.
Mm-hmm.
The only fire station that I recall being closed is the Glen Park station. And, that's another question that was brought up at one point, that hasn't been rebuilt yet. And there was, I thought, a Section 108, community development block grant loan provided to rebuild that station. So we don't know what's going on with that, but that's a separate issue.
At last night's public forum, since you were there, you had a chance to hear what the mayor had to say. We have had some of the brief comments that she made on about what they're dealing with, how they're dealing with the problem now. Is there any indication that you got from listening to the meeting last evening that there will be more that will happen, or are we going to have to wait until the full reports are digested, not only by the State Board of Accounts, but probably other agencies as well?
Well, right now, it doesn't appear that there's going to be a lot more coming out. There may be some pressure from the council. We had three council members there, and they were generally supportive of the mayor. Councilman Brewer did ask a couple of questions. I would like to see the council push further to see where this money went. I don't know if that's going to happen or if they're just going to say, wait for the State Board of Accounts. One of the issues that we have, particularly in Lake County, with corruption, And I'm not saying this is corruption, but I'm just saying in general that we have with corruption is we always wait for somebody else to come in and investigate it. We see the things going wrong, and we don't demand that our elected officials be held accountable as to what's going on. I mean, the council should have been on top of this as well as the mayor. There's no reason that you can't hold them all accountable and ask them to demand answers.
Well, Ken, we're having a number of topics come up here, and there were some other things I'm sure that have come up as well that you've also highlighted in the Northwest Indiana Gazette that we'll have time another program to come back on and talk about. And we thank you for spending time with us today and listening into the conversations last night and rehearing some of those bits of conversation here on the program today, too. We thank you for spending time with us to talk about the public forum that you attended last night in Gary.
Anytime. I love your show, and thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome. This is Ken Davidson, by the way, who is the creator, publisher of the Northwest Indiana Gazette blog, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. More than 50 water fountains are off in some Hammond schools this week because of high lead levels. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports, teachers say that fewer water fountains and faulty air conditioning is making it very difficult for the students to learn.
Morton High School English teacher Lupe Ramirez says it's been about 90 degrees inside her classroom since mid-August. Morton High is one of at least three schools in need of cooling repairs.
It's sort of unlivable. You know, to be there all day. I know I get home at the end of the day feeling sick, and I'm an adult.
The school city of Hammond is providing fans to some classrooms and allowing schools to limit physical activity. The district still has some water fountains available, as well as water coolers filled at taps it expects are safe. But Ramirez says because of the lead, kids don't trust any water from the schools. The district retested fixtures that showed high lead levels. The superintendent says he hopes to have those results, as well as a report on what cooling maintenance is needed, soon. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking, Reporter Roundtable Thursday here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and now let's check in with Andrew Steele with the Times of Northwest Indiana on some of the stories that he's covered recently here. Of course, he does a lot of business-related stories for the Times. And Andrew, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's take a look at the first one here, which is of big importance for commuters in Northwest Indiana. Involves the South Shore Line and approval of a big grant that's going to go toward making some major safety improvements, I understand.
You're talking about what's referred to as positive train control, mm-hmm. which is it's a way for trains to be sort of stopped in the event of an emergency by an automated system that includes a GIS and a computer-based system. So the entire cost of the South Shore is $90-some million, and so the federal government has provided some grants to railroads to help with that, and, mm-hmm. and South Shore is getting one.
Now, how much of the PTC work that the South Shore needs on its line is going to get be able to get covered by this grant?
Yeah, I think less than 10% of it, mm-hmm. I think, it'd be covered by the grant. But that it basically, they had the funding for it themselves, and so what this does is free up some money, capital money, for other things for them.
Now, for folks that aren't familiar with what PTC is, there's a good reason that we should be aware of it, and for safety reasons, certainly on the trains. And we're not only talking, I guess, about commuter lines, but freight trains, too, because it's a big safety issue. We've known about some real serious problems that have resulted because of it.
Yeah, and this is for all major railroads across country, including freight, including Amtrak. And some of the more tragic incidents have occurred with Amtrak, and so it'll do things like prevent collisions between trains and prevent problems in if there's a problem in switching systems and things like that. So definitely a big safety issue.
I get the impression that really the South Shore line is probably doing pretty well here. It's going to cost some other commuter trains a lot more to be able to make sure they make the conversion over to PTC. I imagine Metra and some of the other lines are going to have to shell out a lot more money to do the same kind of work.
Yeah, it's a big, mostly unfunded mandate for them. South Shore, say pretty consistently that they're going to have it done by the end of the year and ready to go, and that's the deadline. So,
one of the stories that you had, I wanted to take a look at here, deals with, I guess, NIPSCO, and in particular, I guess, some things that NIPSCO needs to do to try to face the changes that the Trump administration is making to the Obama-era Clean Power Plan limits. Tell us what the folks at NIPSCO are facing.
Well, NIPSCO actually, for a variety of reasons, is in a situation that they don't need to adjust their plans much, and they don't foresee a big adjustment in plans. What happened with the Clean Power Plan, it came out in 2015 under President Obama, and it aimed to reduce carbon dioxide emissions across country by 32% by 2030, and it left it up to states to figure out how to do that themselves. The Trump revision of that is going to make things much more lenient in terms of emission reductions. But along the way, one of the things that's happened is that natural gas prices have gone down a lot. And so utilities, including NIPSCO, have shifted to natural gas in a significant way. NIPSCO right now is in the process of reducing its coal-fired generation by 50% mm-hmm. Between 2016 and 2023. And so that would meet, they say, the original Clean Power Plan. So obviously it would meet any Trump requirements. And they don't plan to change that, largely because of natural gas prices being low.
Well, you talk about some changes NIPSCO is making in how they're handling their power generation plants and about taking the coal-fired plants offline. I guess one of them is going to come offline relatively soon, early next year, I understand.
Well, Bailey already is offline. That was the end of May. And that's one on Lake Shore. You can see it from Coalsbog. Then they also have the Schaefer Generating Station of Wheatfield. They're going to retire two coal-fired generators there in 2023. And that would leave two more at Schaefer and one in Michigan City.
I know that you had also a chance to talk with the executive director of the Environmental Law and Policy Center in Chicago about the Clean Power Plan, and I know that, that they are all concerned, as I'm sure a lot of environmentalists are concerned, about what the Trump administration wants to do with the Clean Power Plan to abolish it, baby.
Yeah, one of the things about the Clean Power Plan is it really encouraged transition from coal-fired generation to renewable generation mm-hmm. in a variety of ways. And in terms of the environmental groups, ELPC, Sierra Club, people like that, they really want to get rid of all coal-fired generation. And if you ask them about NIPSCO, they would say they would want NIPSCO to do more than 50%. They want to do 100%. And so to the extent that any revisions in the current administration would change that the dynamic of shifting from coal to renewable there, certainly against that.
We're talking with Andrew Steele, who is with the Times of Northwest Indiana, covers business-related and some environmental issues that come up for the newspaper as well. And one of the other stories I know, Andrew, that you had recently is talking, I guess, it may be related in a way, I suppose, to what the South Shore Line wants to do as they expand, do the double-tracking project, in particular between Gary and Michigan City. They want to be able to, and further other places too, of course, is to do some work in the city of Gary in the Miller neighborhood. Tell us how Miller neighborhood is kind of facing some prominent news these days.
Yeah, and this would be not just South Shore, but it would be NDOT would be involved and the city itself involved.
Yeah.
So you'd have basically a realignment of the state highways, 12 and 20, you know, if you think about it, they join up in Miller. In place that they merge would be moved eastward, east of South Shore Station, east of downtown, kind of Miller downtown area. And that would open up a significant amount of property, both for the South Shore to straighten out its tracks and to build a new station, but also for associated development with that.
And we know that I know that there's been concern, I guess, that there's just not any room for new businesses to even think of coming into Miller because there's not much land available. You've got that area there around where the current Miller train station is, and, of course, the tracks take up a lot of space there, and it's going to, I guess, they need to find some way to be able to reroute everybody.
Yeah, it's pretty crowded, and so the realigning the road, which is in that project, will free up some space in that kind of that triangle of area there. Mm-hmm. And then there's all sorts of planning going on regarding transit-oriented development, too.
One of the other stories, too, that you happened to cover for the Times recently involves the Gary-Chicago International Airport. They've got some expansion that they're doing. They've been doing a lot of expansion, for that matter, the last few years. And tell us about the latest plans for doing some work at the airport and how far along it is right now.
Yeah, I mean, if you drive along Airport Road there, you can see a number of new buildings and facilities. On the east end right now, you'll see the steel frame up for a new corporate hangar that the airport is building itself to lease to executive or corporate clients. It's about a $1.5 million project, and they hired a construction manager this week, and they hope to get going on the finishing work on that and have it done, I think, by the end of the year.
Now, I also understand, too, that new customs facility that has been built, in fact, they had the big, grand opening for that not long ago, it's pretty soon going to be turned over to the feds for their operation.
Yeah, I mean, sometime this week and maybe early next week or so, open up to business. Yeah, it's a new facility. It's in an old building, but they sort of rebuilt the inside and redesigned the outside of it. And it will allow them to accept incoming international flights, which mm-hmm. they have not been able to do since 2001.
Now, I've heard some accounts say that, I guess, if you do want to come in on an international flight, that you have to go into Chicago, of course, and it's already crowded there now, and that the furthest beyond the what would be in Gary, if there was something there, which this is supposed to help alleviate, is South Bend, I think. You have to be that far away. You'd end up going to the airport and taking the train back and taking the South Shore Line to come back into Gary.
Yeah, or, you know, they could land at a different airport and actually take off again and land at Gary, you know, go through customs at the first airport and then take off and land at Gary. Yeah. So the idea is this will definitely save the customers money, the incoming clients' money. So.
Well, Andrew, thank you for spending some time talking about the stories that you covered and put out in print as well as online for the Times recently. Andrew Steele is a reporter for the Times, and we thank you much. Hope to have you back on again soon.
All right, thank you.
This is Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Yesterday, we talked at length with Valparaiso Mayor John Costas, and one of the topics we brought up was having enough affordable housing in the city. It's a concern that the Human Relations Council has been discussing, and we talked with the president of the council, Valparaiso University Professor Heath Carter, yesterday about what the mayor wants to do or perhaps needs to do in the time left in his term of office. Professor Carter, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking. speaking today.
Glad to be with you.
Tell us a little bit about the concern that the Human Relations Council has in trying to find out from the administration what kind of plans might be in the works, maybe under review now, we don't know, about a proposed affordable housing study for the city of Valparaiso.
I think for a number of years now, really going back, actually, I mean, more than 10 years, there have been kind of public conversations that have bubbled up at various points in time. As you know, I think anyone who has spent any time in Valparaiso in recent years knows, the city has really gone through this remarkable renaissance. And I mean, we have a very attractive downtown with shops and restaurants and, you know, wonderful amenities and parks and schools. And so there's so many things that make this an attractive community to live and work. But one of the things that we, like many other places around the country, are experiencing is, as we have become a more and more vibrant place to live, housing prices have gone up. And so, you know, I think the conversation has in part been revolving around the question of what can be done to keep many of the wonderful things that are developing and happening in Valparaiso right now going, while we also keep the city open to as many of the folks who work here as we can. And that's the real kind of struggle. We know there's an ALICE study that United Way puts out every few years, and the 2014, I believe, study underscored that 41% of Valparaiso residents are ALICE. They are asset-limited, income-constrained, employed people. They're working people who are really struggling to pay their bills. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of the context for the conversation that's been unfolding over the last few months, which, like I said, is not a brand new conversation, but one that has kind of popped up here and there over the last decade plus.
Now, I know that a few months ago that the housing issue came up, and in fact, I guess the Human Relations Council even endorsed a letter that came from the local clergy, which was encouraging the city to come up with some ways to deal with the problem of a comprehensive housing plan. And I know even Mayor Casas, I guess, has referred this matter is going to come up, I'm sure, maybe in more study in 2019. It's just a matter of that maybe it should come up sooner.
I don't think the Human Relations Council is in a place of being, you know, highly oppositional or something with the mayor and his administration. I think there is a sense of the urgency of the question, and I don't think anyone doubts that we need good information that would come out of a study. And I think there would be, you know, and there is excitement about the idea that a study, especially a study that might lead to some planning around how do we really address this situation. I think there's excitement about that. I mean, the letter that the ministers brought forth a few months ago was also, I thought, well put and well taken, that, you know, there have been a number of studies, there have been a number of different groups that have been, you know, task forces and whatnot, Valpo Next, Altogether Valpo, that have been paying attention to this issue and making recommendations, and that there is some urgency to those recommendations. And I think when the Human Relations Council passed a resolution a couple months ago affirming that letter, it was just to say that we do see this and as an issue that is of a pressing issue, and really to hammer home an issue that affects so many of our residents. We're not talking only about, you know, very poor folks. We do want to talk about them, but we also want to talk about the working and lower middle class who, you know, are here in great numbers and work in our restaurants and work at our elder care facilities and our teachers and whatnot, who are, you know, incredibly, you know, important contributing members of the community and are finding it harder and harder to find a place, a home here to raise their family in. So I think those are the ways in which, you know, there's a balance here. I mean, the other thing, and I think the mayor and I have had many conversations about this and we agree, is that, I mean, this is a complicated issue, and it's complicated for a number of reasons that I'm happy to talk about. But I mean, I think, you know, there's not some magic bullet out there that, you know, the city is, for example, just refusing to take advantage of. It really would require a lot of effort to marshal different solutions and a lot of intentionality. And I think, you know, so in that sense, as much as there's a sense of urgency, there's also a sense of this is a complicated problem that's going to require a lot of attention if we're going to really mount any kind of serious response to it.
Do you get the impression that the Mayor Costas is liable to be able to spend 2019 spending more time on the issue of a comprehensive housing study to be able to address all these issues because there are so many of them?
Yeah. You know, I think that's a good question for the mayor, obviously. I think that the, you know, we are coming, and I think he would say this, I've heard him say this in public addresses, that, you know, his administration is winding down. I mean, this is his, he's entering basically the final year of a very distinguished 16-year term as mayor. And, you know, I think in part what's going to happen with this issue is that it is, it's really, it's a vital question for the future of the city is, you know, who is Valparaiso for in the long term? You know, this is an administration that's done a remarkable job of long-term planning. And as I look at the city in 2018, looking ahead, I think one of the big questions here is, you know, is this going to continue to be a city where you can be a lawyer, a doctor, or a corporate executive, and you can also be a waitress or a waiter or a, you know, someone working in one of our retirement facilities who's making $10 an hour, $7.50 an hour. You know, are we going to be a place that is, you know, welcoming and inviting, not just in sort of spirit, but in truth, to all different kinds of folks? And so I think that that question, I don't know that Mayor Costas in the year he has left is going to be able to sort of figure this problem out, but I think it is an important conversation, and it will be, I think, one of the central questions in the 2019 municipal elections, and I think that's appropriate, and Mayor Costas has been very clear that in his view, it would be best for the city if the election didn't revolve around personalities, but it revolved around issues. And this has certainly got to be right up there as one of the big ones.
Well, certainly would be if we go into 2019, the discussion continues even going into the new year, which it will be before long. That is a very good topic to take up here. And certainly, as you mentioned, something that will be a good point for debate going into the primary election and into the November election in 2019.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think so.
So it's not a question that that it's going to be resolved certainly yet this year, but it's a good topic, a good jumping off point, I suppose, to start the discussion for going into the next election.
Yeah, I really think so. And I think, like I said, it really is related to the question of what is our vision for Valparaiso in the next 15 to 20 years and what direction are we going to be moving in? I think, you know, many, many wonderful things to say about the Costas administration and the ways that the renaissance happening in Valpo. And I think one of the questions for the next election will be, you know, who will this community be for in the next generation?
Well, certainly be a great place to start the conversation going into the new year, to be sure. And thank you very much, Professor Carter, for talking with us about this today.
Thanks so much, Chris, for having me on.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. Our thanks to our reporters and media people with us on the program today, Andrew Steele of the Times of Northwest Indiana and Ken Davidson from the Citizen Journalism blog, the Northwest Indiana Gazette, and with our conversation with from the City of Valparaiso's Human Relations Council, the chairman of the council, Heath Carter. Thank you for being with us. We'll be back with you on Monday.